Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 26th of October, these are our main stories. A US judge has ordered the Trump administration to hand over evidence from the Mueller inquiry into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Several Vietnamese families say they fear their relatives may be amongst the 39 people found dead in a lorry trailer in the UK. And a warning about conditions in camps in northern Syria housing women and children linked to IS. Also in this podcast, more than 60 people are reported killed in clashes in Ethiopia. We find out why the unrest has taken place. And
we've been able to marry the great marketing and the love that people have for the brand with the clear statement that we're going to be part of the solution on the crises that exist.
A senior executive with Coca-Cola tells us his company is working hard to reduce its enormous output of waste plastic. In April, the US Department of Justice published a 448-page report following a lengthy inquiry into claims that Donald Trump's campaign team had colluded with Russia to help him win the 2016 presidential election. The special counsel investigation led by Robert Mueller concluded there was no evidence of a criminal conspiracy. But Democrats in Congress who are investigating whether President Trump obstructed justice were furious. The parts of it were redacted. Well, shortly before we recorded this podcast, a judge ordered the Trump administration to hand over all censored material to a congressional committee. I got the latest from our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler.
So a court has ruled that basically all of Robert Mueller's reports into claims of Russian interference in the 2016 election has to be handed over. Now, of course, Democrats and everybody else has already seen a huge amount of this report, but there was some information that was redacted. What this court has ruled is that all of that information should be handed over to Democrats and Republicans in the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, and that basically that information must also come along with any underlying evidence that was presented before a grand jury. Now, normally, that kind of material is kept secret, but in her ruling, the federal judge has decided that it should be given to this committee, and she says in her ruling that tipping the scale towards disclosure is the public's interest in a diligent and thorough investigation into potentially impeachable conduct by the president described in the Mueller report. So this will be seen as a huge victory for the Democrats as they get more information as they investigate as part of their impeachment inquiries.
Are we expecting any pushback, though, from the White House?
Yeah, I mean, they've been given until the middle of next week to hand over these documents. But I suspect there will be an appeal from the Department of Justice, although we don't know that just yet. But of course, all of this takes place as there continue to be furious rows between the White House and Congress, and indeed inside Congress, about the ongoing impeachment inquiries. There is a feeling from the White House that they are not being treated fairly in all of this. And as we have these discussions about the Mueller investigation, which is coming back into the frame, actually, the US Department of Justice seems to be having its own criminal investigation into the roots of the Mueller investigation itself.
So where are they beginning with that? They've launched this investigation into the inquiry. Why do we think they've done that?
So there was a review that had been taking place beforehand, but it seems now that it has become a criminal probe. Exactly why that's happened, we cannot say. But it basically dates back to right to 2016, when the presidential election was taking place. And the suggestion from the White House is that they want to try to ensure that there was no improper actions from the Department of Justice back then or the FBI under Barack Obama's administration. They're basically saying they want to try to make sure that there was nothing that improperly influenced the election. Now, you can imagine the reaction of Democrats. They have very, very strongly been saying that they don't see any reason for a criminal investigation to be taking place. And they're going further. They're suggesting that this is actually the president trying to obscure things to try and take the attention away from their impeachment inquiries and trying to suggest that perhaps others were applying improper political pressure when they, of course, have accused him of that very action.
Chris Buckler, our Washington correspondent. "I am really, really sorry, Mum and Dad," reportedly the words of 26-year-old farm teacher Mi, sent in a text to her mother on Tuesday. She may have died in a refrigerated lorry trailer along with 38 other people whose bodies were found by British police early on Wednesday. The trailer had travelled from Belgium to a port just outside London. On Thursday, police said they believed all the victims were Chinese. Now, the BBC understands that families in Vietnam fear at least six of their relatives were on the lorry. I asked our correspondent June Kelly what more we know about the message from the young Vietnamese woman and when she sent it.
Well, Claire, what we know is that at 10:30 p.m. British time on Tuesday evening, so that's 3 hours before the bodies were discovered in the lorry, Pham Thi Cha Mi sent this text saying, "I'm really, really sorry, Mum and Dad. My trip to a foreign land has failed. I am dying. I can't breathe. I love you very much, Mum and Dad. I'm from Nen Ton, Ha Tin Province, Vietnam. I am sorry, Mother." The family say the bill for her to be smuggled was £30,000, and they had paid a deposit on this. And she flew from Vietnam to China and from there travelled to France. And on the 19th of October, so that's nearly a week ago, she had attempted to get into the UK, they said, but had been turned back from a British port. We don't know which one. And then they had the terrible text late on Tuesday evening, and they haven't heard anything since.
Who else from Vietnam has been in touch with the BBC?
Well, we have another name of a young man, 20-year-old Nguyen Duong Luong, who'd been in France for a year but evidently wanted to get to the UK. His family are very concerned about him. We also know of two other families, the families of a 19-year-old woman and a 26-year-old man who fear they may have died. Now, the brother of the teenage girl said his sister called him on Tuesday evening saying she was getting into a container and was turning off her phone to avoid detection. And he hasn't heard from her since. Now, the brother said a people smuggler had returned money to the family. And also the family of the 26-year-old man she was travelling with have also had some money sent back to them. But the BBC understands that there are at least six Vietnamese feared to be amongst the dead.
So I know the police have been speaking. Well, what have they said?
We heard from Deputy Chief Constable Pippa Mills. The big news from her statement was that a 48-year-old man from Northern Ireland was arrested at Stansted Airport on suspicion of conspiring to traffic people and also 39 counts of manslaughter. Now, his arrest comes after a couple from Warrington in Cheshire were arrested on suspicion of the same offences. And also the lorry driver, Mo Robinson, he remains in custody.
June Kelly. Well, across the English Channel, people smuggling networks are still planning to traffic migrants from French ports. Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to talk to people at one of the migrant camps on the French coast about their experiences and their reaction to the news of the deaths in Britain.
We took camp in the woods near Dunkirk. It's a place where you queue for everything while waiting for only one thing: the chance to hide inside a lorry bound for the UK.
You know, yesterday it was 39 people victims, so everyone was scared to go any lorry or anything. So there is, it's very hard, all scared.
Serbaz, one of the hundreds camping here under the dripping trees, arrived from Iraq last week with his wife, who's 8 months pregnant. With such tight security at the ports, smugglers are their only hope, he says, but you never know what you're signing up to.
Whatever they said, go to this lorry, you haven't got choice, you have to go. It's not about I'm choosing, I'm going or no. There's no choice, honestly. You have to go. They're capable for doing anything. So when you're dealing with them, you have to obey them and whatever they told you, you have to do.
A Kurdish man, Taish, told us he'd already tried several times to cross the channel in refrigerated lorries.
Many of us are found by control of the border, and they saved us from death. Sometimes we are happy for them to save our life. Sometimes we are sad because they didn't let us to go to the UK.
Security may be tight at Dunkirk and Calais, but these ports are attractive because they're so close to the UK. As one man here put it, if you're going to cross in the back of a lorry, 3 hours is better than seven.
This is my tent. Yeah, this is my tent.
One of Ramin's relatives has already had to be rescued once from an airtight container. Has this latest incident in the UK changed his mind?
I don't know. I feel confused, okay? But I have to do it by lorry. Because if you go by sea, you don't know what happened in the sea. Maybe falling the sea and no one can help you there.
People smugglers can charge up to 10,000 euros per person for passage to the UK. But Taish says costs here are weighed differently.
We are between two deaths. If we go back to our country, it's death. If we're trying to UK, it's maybe death. But I think it's a good death, better than our death in our country.
The situation in camps in northern Syria has long been critical, with women and children connected to the self-styled Islamic State being held by Kurdish troops struggling to contain them. Now, with Turkey's offensive in the area continuing, there's a growing risk of mass prisoner escapes, and charities say humanitarian care is almost non-existent. Dareen Khalifa is a senior Syria analyst at the International Crisis Group, and in the past few years she's been visiting camps in northern Syria. She's just visited one called Al-Hol, and she told Paul Henley about the conditions there.
Al-Hol is the biggest camp in northeastern Syria at the moment. It houses around 70,000 IDPs, internally displaced persons, including 11,000 foreign women and their kids. There's around 3,000 women. The rest are children. They are mostly from around 53 countries. So there are also around 30,000 Iraqis and I guess the same number of Syrians. The camp is divided into several sections and the foreigners are put in a separate section with intensive protection from the People's Protection Unit, from the Kurdish militia currently governing northeastern Syria. During my visit in the camp, I was trying to look at the impact of the Turkish offensive on the Kurds' ability to protect the camp. And it was very interesting to see how much they're stretched thin in trying to cater to the camp and to offer protection. They were already very stretched thin prior to the Turkish offensive. They had around 300 officers doing perimeter security and 400 others doing internal policing of the camp. When the Turkish offensive started in the towns of Tel Abyad and Ras and Ain, they had to pull out almost half of these forces to send them to the border cities to help defend against the Turkish offensive, which left the camp vulnerable to a number of things, including attacks by the residents against the security forces, but also a lot of smuggling attempts. Just in the past week, they were able to arrest around 80 women who were attempting to smuggle themselves out of the camp. And we are expected to see more and more of that if the Kurdish forces are not given sufficient support or if they continue to be split between trying to protect their Kurdish hometowns and to protect also ISIS prisoners that are living in the camp.
And tell me about conditions in the camp, both from a health point of view and from a security point of view. Are they dangerous places to live?
When I first visited the camp a few months ago, it was already very dire. No one had expected these large numbers of people coming into the camp, and the Kurdish forces were just not prepared for it. They had some NGOs trying to offer limited support, but when the Turkish offensive started, almost all NGOs pulled out, leaving only the Kurdish Red Crescent operating in the camp. So between the Kurdish administration and the Kurdish Red Crescent, there's just no way for them to be able to respond to the increasing needs of the people there. And that is also leading to a lot of grievances among people living in the camp. And it is leading to a lot of unrest and attacks against the security guards. So it's a vicious cycle, really. Because they're not able to cater to the needs, there is growing frustration and growing violence. And it really is a situation that is just deteriorating day after day.
Dareen Khalifa, a senior Syria analyst at the International Crisis Group. Now, let's talk about the social media platform TikTok. It's hit back against claims of Chinese government interference over content shown on the app. Senior politicians in the US think TikTok, that's the app that allows users to share short videos, poses a threat to the security of their country. Kerry Allen is our China media analyst.
China doesn't see it as a national security risk, and it says that this is a problem that exists between China and the US, that long term the US is afraid of China's growing power. I mean, going back to the whole Huawei incident, it was suggested that Huawei, the tech giant, was related to endangering national security, but China said no, that's not the case whatsoever. It's doing really, really well, and the US is threatened by that. LinkedIn is one of the few US platforms that exists in mainland China, but also internationally, and they have completely different setups. So yes, TikTok that is accessible in China, the content on it is completely different to in the US, for example, and overseas. So the difficulty is that in mainland China, the government is very sensitive about people seeing content that might be against the government. So there are censors, government censors, who actually actively remove content. But overseas, it's not too concerned because it's more concerned with content that affects its national population than people overseas. That being said, China has seen this app as an opportunity to promote its soft power. So there have been, I mean, I've seen, for example, the foreign ministry had this nice funky video set to dance music that it was promoting heavily back when it launched its TikTok platform. And yeah, this was one of the opportunities that the government thought we can actually show our power to the West.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. Now, here's a question. Do you understand Brexit? It is bewildering even to many in the UK, and that is why the Global News Podcast got together with the hit Brexit Cast podcast. Brexit Cast is presented by some of the BBC's top political reporters, and it's an in-depth but irreverent look at the latest Brexit machinations. Over the last few weeks, we've been inviting listeners to this podcast to send in their Brexit-related questions. And in the Global News Brexit Cast, we put those questions to the team. So, if you want to know what Brexit really means, in the company of people who know this complicated story in all its detail, just look for the Global News Brexit Cast. You'll find it a little further down the Global News podcast feed. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
A lot of people do withdraw from using the internet and using this technology because it's scary being monitored and tracked all the time.
The rise in the use of so-called stalkerware and the impact it has on the lives of victims. Now, just a few weeks ago, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, protesters in the east of the country have burnt copies of his new book in solidarity with the prominent activist and journalist Jawar Mohammed. Tragically, so far, 67 people have been killed. It all started on Wednesday when Mr. Mohammed claimed the government was trying to remove his bodyguards. More now from our Africa editor, Will Ross.
Jawar Mohammed is a very well-known activist and journalist in Ethiopia. He spent years in exile in America, from where he launched a very popular Oromo media network, it's called, and it's still, you know, it has hundreds and hundreds of thousands of views of things that are posted on Facebook, and it actually played quite a big part in the protest movement that went on for a couple of years that led to the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed coming to power. But what happened is, when Abiy Ahmed carried out all these reforms, some of which, of course, led to him being given the Nobel Peace Prize, one of the reforms was to invite back people who were in exile. And Jawar Mohammed came back to the country, and he's become, it seems, more and more disillusioned with the way the Prime Minister is taking the country. And this is what he said about the Prime Minister.
He is resorting to the early signs of dictatorship, of trying to intimidate people, even with his very close allies, individuals who helped him come to power, who happen to disagree with some of the policies and positions, ideologies he's advocating. You know, intimidation is the start of authoritarian rule.
So, Will, you mentioned Jawar Mohammed's media network when he was in exile, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has criticised foreign-run media outlets for inciting violence. So was that criticism directed at Jawar Mohammed?
It seems it was. And he said some people can broadcast or report things and then they have the luxury of going back to live in a country where they're a citizen and leaving us to suffer the consequences. So the deaths that we're talking about, that's in six different towns across Oromia, across the region. So, you know, this is a major problem for the Prime Minister to sort out. And it shows not only the ethnic problem that there is, because it's believed that many of those who were killed were not from Oromia State. So the perceived persecution of Jawar Mohammed brought out some sort of ethnic anger in people. There's an election due next year, and Jawar Mohammed himself has suggested that he could run for office, which would be a major headache for the current Prime Minister, who would like to run again.
Will Ross, our Africa editor. The president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has described sanctions as a cancer that's destroying the country's economy. Demonstrations have been taking place in many cities in protest against measures enforced by the European Union and the United States. But Western governments say mismanagement and corruption are to blame, not sanctions which target a few individuals. Our correspondent Andrew Harding reports now from Johannesburg.
This was not a spontaneous mass protest, but rather a series of small marches orchestrated by the Zimbabwean authorities.
Sanctions live to call.
The aim, to convince people that the country's current economic crisis is not the government's fault, but rather Europe and America's. Limited Western sanctions were first imposed many years ago, in the era of President Robert Mugabe. They targeted more than 100 individuals suspected of involvement in rigging elections and political violence. But there is no evidence that those sanctions have had any significant broader economic impact. After Mugabe was forced out 2 years ago, his successor promised tough reforms and honest government. But progress has been slow, public trust absent, and the economy has taken another nosedive. Today, Britain pointedly urged Zimbabwe's leaders to focus on fighting corruption and human rights abuses rather than organising marches. The exact impact and value of the sanctions is still fiercely debated, but they don't seem to have achieved much. Instead, they've been used repeatedly and effectively by the Zimbabwean government for anti-Western propaganda purposes.
Andrew Harding with that report. The Coca-Cola Company is the world's largest plastic polluter. Every year, it produces over 100 billion plastic bottles. And a recent global audit found there was more Coca-Cola plastic waste in our environment than from the next three big consumer companies combined. But its global chief executive, James Quincey, insists that Coca-Cola is taking big steps to tackle this. He's been speaking to the BBC's business editor, Simon Jack.
Coke is a growing brand, and I think it's growing because we've been able to marry the great marketing and the love that people have for the brand with the clear statement that we're going to be part of the solution on the crises that exist.
According to a recent global audit, you were found to be the most plastic polluting brand, more plastic found in this audit than the next three consumer companies combined. You've got to, you know, starting from the back of the pack, aren't you?
I mean, part of the reason people find us is we're the leader. But I think when you look at what the ambition we set, which is to recover every bottle for every one we sell by 2030, and then to use 50% of them back in our own bottles as food-grade plastic, which is the highest value use of plastics, where are we now? Well, we already recover 59% of our bottles, and we already use 9% of our bottles back in new bottles. So we've still got some way to go. But what we've proven to ourselves is because plastic bottles can create a circular economy, everyone you can collect can be made into a new bottle, we've driven up collection. We've driven up collection in developed economies like parts of Western Europe. We've driven up recovery in places like Mexico and South Africa and Vietnam. And we've got it from low percentages all the way to 70%. So without new innovation, this is a solvable problem and solvable in a very short space of time. So this absolutely can be done.
You've committed to recycling and collecting one bottle for every one that you produce. Are you actually going to produce less plastic yourself?
No, we're going to produce the bottles, but we're going to be reusing our own bottles so it'll truly be a circular economy. We can find an intersection between waste and carbon footprint, because one of the dangers of focusing on plastics and going all plastics bad, everything else good, is it misses what has economic value and what can be reused. And actually, part of the problem with plastics is people are going, well, I'll have cans or glass. But when you bring the climate crisis into focus as well, we ultimately, as a world, need to radically reduce our use of carbon so that everyone can enjoy the same living standards as the West, ultimately. What we need to do is bring down the carbon footprint. Glass and cans have higher, much higher carbon footprints than recycled plastics. So actually, the sweet spot of the waste crisis and the climate crisis is actually recycled plastic. Get rid of the plastic that's only ever going to have a single use, but drive up the reuse of plastic. And it's doable. Yes, we got to 59%, but we can get to 100. We reckon we can get to 100% in Western Europe by 2025. We reckon that globally we can get there by 2030.
James Quincey, Global Chief Executive of Coca-Cola. Women's charities here in Britain are concerned by new research that shows an increase in the use of so-called stalkerware. This is surveillance software that allows complete access to a victim's phone, showing private messages, GPS location, and even giving someone the ability to see and hear through another person's cameras and microphones. The use of the software has risen by at least 37% in the last year. Joe Tidy now reports on the scale of the problem and the trauma it can create for victims.
There were just little things that were dropped in the conversation that never felt right. He knew details about my friends. I began to wonder how he knew where I was all the time.
For months it went on like this. Amy, not her real name, became more and more paranoid. Either she was losing her mind or someone was telling her abusive husband everything. In the end, she found out the truth by accident when he handed her his phone. He wanted to show her a picture of their son, but a notification caught her eye.
I saw an email alert that said, daily report on my Mac. And I just had this chill go through me. I stopped breathing for a minute.
Amy was a victim of so-called stalkerware, surveillance software installed in secret on her computer to monitor her online life. It's been years since her ordeal, and advances in technology mean this sort of software is more powerful than ever.
You're going to use this phone. This is effectively the, we'll call it the perpetrator's phone. Okay. You've got access to everything I do on this phone. We'll call this phone the victim's phone.
I installed one of the most popular brands onto my work phone and allowed our producer, Joanne, to follow my movements for 2 days.
So this is quite creepy.
She could see a map of my precise location. She could read all my texts and see what I had on my screen.
There are alerts that come up, so if he gets a text or doesn't update on social media, then I can see that as well. And it tells me he has 18 updates. I can see everything.
And at any point in secret, she could see through my cameras and listen into the microphone.
That is so bizarre. I can see Joe picking up a bike.
Cybersecurity company Kaspersky has recently started warning its customers when this software is detected on phones. They've noticed a 37% increase in detections globally. Russia, India, Brazil and the US top the list for stalkerware. David M is the company's principal security researcher.
In the period since the beginning of this year, we found that about 37,500 people were affected by this. That's a global figure.
Do you think this is just a small fraction of the actual true figure?
It's the tip of the iceberg, to be honest.
Hello, my name is Moni. I'm calling from Safer Places.
At Safer Places, domestic abuse victims are helped out of dangerous relationships.
You want to call me when you're ready?
Gemma Toynton is the charity's lead on stalking. She says stalkerware is having a long-term impact on survivors.
A lot of people do withdraw from using the internet and using this technology because it's scary being monitored and tracked all the time.
You can hear footsteps. Gosh, there's no delay on it or anything. There's no interference. It's so clear.
The software I downloaded cost just £140 for 3 months. 24-hour tech support helped me get it onto the phone and hide it after I told them openly in a live chat that it was my wife's phone I was trying to download it to.
So now it sounds like he's back on the street.
Few countries, including the UK, have any specific laws against the use of it, although it is illegal under offences like harassment or coercive and controlling behaviour. The companies advertise as employee or child monitoring services and warn against misuse with disclaimers online. The simple advice from cybersecurity professionals to protect yourself from stalkerware is to restrict physical access to your devices, use strong passcodes, and install a security product to detect any malicious software.
Joe Tidy with that report. Finally, Russian scientists tracking migrating eagles have been forced to start a crowdfunding campaign after realising that some of the birds had been sending costly text messages. Sasha Schlichter explains.
The project tracks the migration routes of eagles who fly off to the vast steppes of Kazakhstan to spend the summer. Problem is, there's no mobile coverage there. Each eagle is equipped with a Russian mobile SIM card, which constantly transmits data. So when some of the birds wandered into Iran and Pakistan, they did get a signal, a very expensive one. A single text from there cost nearly $1. So when all the data got dumped in one go, it instantly depleted the researchers' budget. Thanks to the crowdfunding campaign, they now hope to keep the eagle's SIM cards running until they return home from faraway lands.
Sasha Schlichter. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.